Well, I want you to put yourself in Kenneth Ireland's shoes. There he is, convicted of murder, and he's at prison at age 18. This 1986 rape and slaying of Barbara Pelkey, she was a Wallingford mother of four. And the poor guy, I mean, he spent about 21 years behind bars, not only here in the state of Connecticut. Remember that plan that John Rowland had to send them down to Virginia, to a place that was a real hellhole in Virginia? And he ended up there, too. And, I mean, the scars, the damage, it is really almost something you can't calculate. But, of course, the state of Connecticut, with some new laws in place after something that happened to Mr. Tillman back in 2007, getting back some recompense for time that was served unjustly. And Kenneth Ireland was the beneficiary, if you will, of that attempt to remedy what happened to him as a result of the judicial process here in the state of Connecticut. And representing him was attorney Bill Bloss, who has been on this program many times, an excellent presenter of information to us, Koskoff and Beter. So you represented Ken Ireland. We had the two of you on several years back prior to knowing what the outcome would be. And you had to approach the claims commissioner here in the state of Connecticut, J. Paul Vance Jr. from Waterbury, and to tell us about the process. And do you think that the way it all came out was fair to your client?
Well, I do, actually. I think, and thank you for having me on, Larry. You know, you kind of highlight a fascinating issue, and that is, what is the responsibility of the state to try to take care of somebody who this just unspeakable, unimaginable disaster, horror happened to? And I think most people accept that really the state of Connecticut is who put Ken Ireland in jail. It was not a private litigation. It was not a victim of a crime. It was the state of Connecticut. The state of Connecticut offered the reward that led to the two people testifying against him. The state of Connecticut had the judge sign an arrest warrant and the judgment ultimately. And so I think that the state is really to be commended to accept the responsibility that it bore some of the blame here, really. And I don't mean that in terms of a willful maliciousness. I don't think anybody wanted Ken Ireland to be convicted if he wasn't guilty, at least connected to the state. But nonetheless, it was the state of Connecticut that put him in. And this, I think, is a very thoughtful, very well-reasoned law. And clearly, the best would be to turn the clock back and the whole thing never happened. But you know what? That's just not an option. It's not an option in any serious tragedy, whether it's a truck accident or just any other kind of problem that people come to talk to lawyers about.
Well, I've got to tell you, the sympathy that he gained from this, having lost perhaps the best years of his life, things that he's never going to get back. I don't care what kind of money you put on the table. Nonetheless, I mean, he's rebuilding his life, but you can only imagine. I mean, he has PTSD as a result of this. Remind people of some of the horrors that he went through in his correctional facility experience.
Well, he was—he had the dubious distinction of being the youngest inmate at what was then the maximum security state prison, the Summers Prison. He did go in at 18 is when he was arrested, but he actually was held in the county jail for a couple of years, and then at age 20 he was sent up to Summers Prison, and he was the youngest guy in the Summers Prison for a period of time until he got older. I kind to start at the beginning, really, he was in a 6-by-8-foot cell, and the person that he shared his cell with actually was a murderer. He did commit a terrible homicide, and so he, Ireland, is not only the youngest guy up in Osborne, but he is actually in a tiny space with a really bad guy. Now, it got worse from there in many respects. There was an inmate on one of his blocks who was burned alive outside of his cell and who wound up dying. You mentioned the Wallins Ridge, the Virginia experience.
Yeah.
What a horrible place that was in his telling of it. And the guards didn't want him there. The prisoners didn't want to be there. It was just a terrible, terrible fit, terrible mix. But, you know, anybody, frankly, I think most people I've talked to have said, you know what, I'm not sure it's enough. I mean, we recognize that it's fair under the circumstances all the way around. I've had one or two people say, gee, isn't that a lot? And I think my response to that fellow was, well, would you take it? Would you do 21 years in a 6x8-foot cell in exchange for $6 million?
I don't think I could have lasted 5 days in the circumstances that he was placed in. Imagine the psychological impact of knowing you're innocent and nobody, able to prove that for 21 years. And thankfully, the Innocence Project and others getting involved in this. I mean, how important is it for us to continually revisit from time to time these cases and make certain that justice was done? Because I know a lot of people hate the appeals process and hate, how much attention we spend on people that we consider to be bad guys. But there are enough good guys who have rotted in prison, and it's unwarranted. But tell people what they, should be reminded of about our system.
Well, any human, I really deeply respect our legal system. It is a very good system. However, it is a human-created institution. Any human-created institution is imperfect. And we have rules that try to shave down the amount of imperfection, like the rule of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, not convicting unless you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the person is guilty. But, the fact is, sometimes that isn't enough. And for example, 12 jurors unanimously said, Ken Ireland, we believe beyond a reasonable doubt you committed this murder. And he didn't. And a judge denied his motion for a new trial, believing that he committed the murder. The Connecticut Supreme Court voted 7-0 to affirm his conviction. Another judge denied a post-conviction writ of habeas corpus. He managed to convince not a single person of his innocence. And in fact, the sentencing judge, and I wonder if he's aware and if he's I haven't tried to, I haven't obviously corresponded with him, but the sentencing judge had some very rough remarks about how Mr. Ireland, you've refused to accept responsibility for committing this terrible crime. You keep saying that you're innocent, but you're just, you're disserving yourself. You would like to, and it turns out, of course, Ireland was right. He was innocent, but, it really ought to cause us to take a breath and say, what can we do to make sure this never happens again?
Oh, absolutely. You think about it, he was betrayed up and down the line. And, we think that we're searching for justice in these cases, but it certainly was not found here. Now, as it relates to recompense, analysis of damages, just break it down. For those who are wondering, how did J. Paul Vance Jr., the claims commissioner, come up with the $6 million figure? Run it down for us.
Sure. It really runs into a few different areas, and some of them are tangible, and you can really kind of measure in terms of dollars pretty easily, things like lost earnings. I think one time when Ken was locked up, he sent away to the Social Security Administration to see what his Social Security retirement was going to be, and it's kind of, I think he was doing it for, he had a lot of time to kill, obviously, but, his Social Security benefits at one time were something like 50 cents a month, if he lived to age 65. And got out. So, he lost earnings for, as you noted, Larry, your peak earning years and peak educational years. He lost the ability to get, he was on the way into the National Guard, actually, at the time he was arrested. And so he lost the ability to get vocational training and all of that. But part of the award was for lost earnings for that 21 years. But the majority of the award was for what we call non-economic damages, and that is things like the loss of the ability to live one's life at liberty, the loss of the ability to continue your familial relationships. His dad passed away while he was locked up, which has got to be just horribly frustrating.
Yeah, and he obviously could not attend. And I mean, there was an article talking about him kind of sitting there and reflecting the day of his father's funeral.
Yeah. And things like fright, things like, you know, emotional distress, what we would kind of refer to colloquially as pain and suffering, perhaps. You know, he did have some physical injuries in prison. Fortunately, he did not have any, he didn't have any assaults I guess it's a degree, not really bad assault. He didn't have any assaults that led to permanent damage, but he certainly had there. He was assaulted certainly in prison in terms of getting into fistfights and so forth. He had to do that, and he felt that he had to do it anyway under his circumstances. So the award was predominantly for the kind of the non-economic piece of it, the loss of liberty, the fright, the emotional distress, the severing of familial relationships, and so forth. Now, is there a formula? No, there's not a formula. Mr. Vance, I think he considered, and I think he was right to consider, the award that the legislature made in the Tillman case 5 years ago or 6 years ago now. It's a little hard to argue that that the Tillman case would be either an outlier as too high or an outlier as too low, given the circumstances between Tillman and Ireland were rather close in many respects. So I think Mr. Vance said, look, you know, that was the considered judgment of the legislature in Tillman's case. It's a little bit different in Ireland's case, so I'm going to do a few things differently. But I think he very thoughtfully used that as a framework.
And he was quoted as saying, this is J. Paul Vance, Jr., the claims commissioner, I offer my sincerest apologies to Mr. Ireland for the burden that he was forced to suffer, and I wish him the best of luck. And, of course, he just got an appointment by Dana Malloy, the governor. Explain that.
Yeah, boy, I think this was just brilliant, and I would love to say it was my idea, but I had nothing to do with it. I got a call from Ken one day saying, "Gee, you know, I've got this." I got a phone call from the lieutenant governor's office, and the governor is thinking about appointing me to the Board of Pardons and Paroles. And I was like, "Geez, that's pretty creative." I think it's highly likely that Ken is the first person ever to serve 21 years in prison, who is now sitting on a Board of Pardons and Parole. But he took his oath. He was approved by the legislature unanimously earlier this year, and he actually has been sitting on parole hearings for the last 3 months. It's just a brilliant. I'm very impressed with the appointment. He is somebody who is very thoughtful and is very aware. He took advantage of every program in prison that you could take advantage of. So I think he is very capable of kind of separating people who are at high risk for recidivism, who haven't done what they should have done, who haven't followed the rules, and from, on the other hand, people who may have earned a second chance by showing that they have accepted what they did and are ready to be productive members of society. I think it was brilliant. I've talked to him about how he likes it so far, and he's very taken it very seriously. He recognizes that public safety is the paramount issue, but knows what happens in prison, knows what's available and what people can do.
I ran into him several years ago. I was up at Connecticut Public Television, and I was pledging one night, and somebody told me his story because he was volunteering. At that time, he had just gotten out of prison, and he was looking, you know, to find his way. And obviously, it's difficult to find work. So he was volunteering at Connecticut Public Television, and he was out there collecting all the pledges and seemed like just an average guy, never knowing the backstory, as many cases we don't. What a remarkable backstory. And congratulations to you, Bill Bloss. I mean, you have an incredible reputation, and you took this one on pro bono. I mean, you just really wanted to see justice served here. So congratulations to you.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it seemed, frankly, after the job that the public defender's office did in getting him out, that it just didn't seem sporting, to be honest with you, to try to earn any fee on representing him. And I think as Tim Fisher, the UConn dean, law school dean, who also helped me get me involved, said, look, it's important that the legal community accept some a role in trying to make things better. And so, yeah, we did it on those terms, and so I'm very pleased to say that he is this is going to take care of him for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And I hope he took you out for a good dinner. I mean, at least. But Bill Bloss,
it wouldn't shock me that he would do that.
No, not at all.
He is a delightful guy, and I will say, you know, when I met him 5 years ago, I was amazed at the lack of bitterness, and yeah, I'm sure you picked that up last time he was on. You know what, Larry? He's still exactly that way. He has.
Amazing.
This was a very long, dark chapter in his life, but he has closed that chapter, and he is now living for the rest of his life. And all sorts of good lessons for all of us in that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming by today. Bill Bloss from Koskoff and Beter, and we will rely upon you in the future, as we have in the past on many cases. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.